Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly 3/4 of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley. It's the morning after the budget night before, and Philip Hammond could be forgiven for getting a bit giddy at all of the positive coverage for his policies rather than his jokes. He heralded the beginning of the end of austerity, blowing a multi-million pound windfall on tax cuts and extra spending. But what was hidden in the small print? Does it make an election more likely? And who will actually have more money in their pocket? Joining me to answer those questions and others posed by Times Red Box readers are a stellar panel of Times experts who almost look like they might have recovered from covering the budget yesterday. Anne Ashworth is the Times Money and Property Editor. Oliver Wright is the Times Policy Editor. But we begin with the economics, and this is the Times Business Editor, Richard Fletcher.
The Office for Budget Responsibility handed Philip Hammond a lifeline by reducing its borrowing forecasts over 5 years and marginally raising growth forecasts. But amid all the euphoria, little attention was paid to the fact the UK economy continues to lag its major competitors.
So, Richard, let's just talk about the numbers first of all. Exactly how much more money did Philip Hammond have to play with?
So he had £68.5 billion over 5 years. So he was given a huge amount of headroom by the OBR, of which he used 97% of it to fund, obviously, Theresa May's promise on the NHS funding and also to do various giveaways, including raising the personal allowances faster than had previously been promised. So this was a giveaway budget.
Where does this money magically appear from? If people suddenly think, well, how did he start the week not having this money up his sleeve? And, you know, he suddenly found £68 billion. Where's that from?
So the OBR basically has its forecast, and they basically admitted that actually they've been getting it wrong for the last few years, and actually borrowing's going to be a lot less than they'd expected, which obviously gave him a huge amount of headroom. These are forecasts, not actual numbers, so they may have to claim these back in a few years' time.
And actually, if you look at the track record of the OBR, it's not brilliant. The borrowing forecasts are sort of, if you put them all since 2010 on a graph, it's just a sort of a series of sort of snakes just moving further and further across to the right-hand side. That magical aim of eradicating the deficit just moves further into the distance.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously, the last budget we had the major revisions to their productivity forecast. So they conceded that they'd been massively overestimating our ability to recover the productivity that we lost, in the aftermath of the financial crisis. So yeah, even by economists' high standards, the OBR, you know, you could argue its forecasting ability isn't great. But then obviously, you are looking at a crystal ball, and that's not easy.
And so, what is the state of the economy?
The economy is, you know, we're not in recession. Obviously, there was a lot of talk after the Brexit vote about Project Fear and back into recession. But we are basically in this period of low growth. So we've got very low growth, less than 2%. We've got very low levels of unemployment. So we've got very low inflation, although we're starting to see a little bit of inflation come back, but not a huge amount. So we're in this kind of what I would call slightly boring period of low growth, low inflation, low unemployment.
And what did you make of the big economic picture that Philip Hammond laid out in his budget?
Well, I sat there thinking, are we resilient enough to be able to take any shocks that Brexit could deliver? I'm going to say that phrase, the unknown unknowns that could result when we exit, in whatever state we exit from the EU. And he didn't give me that sense of reassurance that a good Chancellor can give you, even in fairly dire times.
There was an argument, you could say, that having bagged all this extra money from the magic money tree, just banking that and just saying, let's just get through the next 6 months, see what happens with Brexit. We might need this for some, like you say, some shocks.
I wanted to hear the words war chest against times ahead, but then perhaps, you know, I'm a traditionalist in these matters.
What did you make of it,
okay,
Ollie?
Pick up on Anne's point. I don't think Philip Hammond wanted to give us much reassurance. I mean, he wants a soft Brexit. He is fighting a bitter internal battle against those both in the cabinet who want a slightly harder form of Brexit and more broadly against the Brexiteers on the backbenches. I think this budget was framed in a way to scare people. It was designed to say to them, well, you know, things might be all right, we might be able to spend this, but you know all this money?
So what you're saying is he made sure there was no slack, giving the ardent Brexiteers no scope whatsoever. Yes. That they would have to agree to what he and Mrs. May present to them as a way of exiting the EU.
I think that's his intention. Whether he succeeds or not is a completely different matter.
We'll come on to Brexit later. But Richard, in terms of our position in the sort of in the world, fifth biggest economy, sixth biggest, you know, this, explain why we seem to be going up and down this league table of
economies.
Well,
there's not much up in the league table. We're slipping down. So we are growing a little bit faster than Italy, but not much faster than the rest of the G7. So we are at the bottom of the table. We are the sort of Huddersfield, if you like, of...
In terms of growth rather than the size of the economy.
In terms of growth, yeah, absolutely, which obviously is important. So I just to pick up on Anne's point, I did think what was quite interesting about this budget, it was, although for the sort of Westminster folk, perhaps the change in language wasn't a surprise, you know, if you'd followed May's comments about the end of austerity, this was a big shift in the budget in that, you know, this was a big change in borrowing strategy. The commitment to eliminate the deficit went out the window. Treasury idea of, you know, you've got to get the deficit down seems to have fallen away, and yet the markets barely moved. So sterling was basically flat on the day, gilts have barely moved. And so I do think that is quite interesting, and maybe that, you know, as Simon Nixon, our economist, was saying to me earlier today, the markets will only worry when you're in trouble. But there was a big shift in the tone in terms of borrowing and the commitment to austerity, and yet the markets just seem to shrug that off.
And we were told in 2010 when the coalition was formed and we had to tackle the deficit and we had to set out a plan to eradicate it because we didn't want to be Greece, we couldn't cope with a massive crash. What do you think has changed? Is it just time that we haven't teetered on the edge like that?
Well, I think it's partly that, you know, deficit as a percentage of GDP is now much lower, so we are in a much better position as part of GDP. But yesterday there was this change in tone, and I think that was quite significant, and I was quite surprised at how the market's just completely ignored that.
Before we move on, a couple of questions from readers. Gordon Dow said, would we have had a stronger economy if Cameron hadn't held a referendum? Now, this is like the opposite of a forecast. This is a sort of retrospective reimagining of the past. But what impact has the referendum, the outcome, had?
I mean, the answer to that is clearly yes, without doubt. You know, we've seen this huge growth in the US economy, you know, sparked by Trump's stimulus, to, you know, his changes to the tax regime and also his deregulation. And we've also seen stronger growth in Europe. And typically, you would have seen the UK economy follow that, and that we should have seen much higher growth over the last few years. And clearly, the answer to that is yes.
Is it right that I saw somewhere buried deep in one of the documents that comes out, the economy is 2.2% smaller?
Yeah, I've seen that figure in recent weeks. There's been lots of research undertaken both by City Economists and some of the think tanks that's come to a sort of similar level.
Just finally, before we move on from the sort of economics of it, Lara Bolenghi, the Times writer, commenting on one of our many budget stories online, she was saying it wasn't a budget, this is a prank. Money they didn't know they had appeared at the last minute so they could pretend spend it with the proviso that it'll be torn up if necessary. Will he at some point have to come back and revisit all of this?
Well, it very much depends of whether the OBR have got their sums right. So that, you know, he's been hit in the past by budgets where the OBR forecasts have been, you know, more pessimistic than expected, and he's had to have a tougher time. So, you know, this was a lucky chance to review like this, because this may well be, let's be honest, his last budget. One thing, point I would make is that he has started to fall in this habit, of Gordon Brown habit, of hiding stuff in the Red Book. So there were lots of big announcements. So Help to Buy, no mention in the speech, but there was actually quite a significant change to that in the Red Book. You know, his big signature move, you know, the tax on plastic, that actually won't come into force until April 2022, and he just forgot to mention that date during the speech. There's a tax on heated tobacco products. That's quite a significant change. Again, no mention in the speech, buried in the Red Book. You know, so I do think he is falling into that Gordon Brown habit, and yet we still got these mentions of these 10 million for church halls, you know, planning for public conveniences. I do think we should have a ban on chancellors mentioning any measure that has an effect of less than 250 million on the economy. They should just be banned. There should be like an OBR.
Because those small amounts of money are just there to make jokes. So we had, he spent 10 million pounds on something to do with fly tipping, just to make a joke about how John McDonald fallen over some rubbish. In the past, George Osborne did it. He'd spent $5 million on something just to make a joke about Boris Johnson.
You're absolutely right. And the speech was actually longer than his speech. It was over an hour, and typically he's a bit shorter than that. And yet, so he has room for all these terrible jokes, and they were really terrible.
Really bad.
And yet, these really important measures, he just doesn't mention at all. And that really is a sort of, you know, that really is a return to the bad old days. So I think, as well as having the OBR, we should have a sort of a regulator. I don't normally like regulators, but I'll make an exception on this occasion. We should have a regulator of the speech that should say that's too small a measure, you've got to take it out.
You can't answer. And presumably, Anne, the message that you would give to Philip Hammond when he's looking ahead to his OBR is that the value of his what's in his coffers can go up as well as down, which is you know what money editors tell readers all the time.
I like a prudent chancellor myself. I like a stingy kind of guy, really. You know, for preference.
So you preferred Philip Hammond Mark One rather than the one we had this week?
Oh, yeah, spreadsheet Phil, please, yes. I don't want sunshiny, jokey Phil. I want spreadsheet Phil.
I don't think anybody wants to hear jokey Philip Hammond ever again after his very peculiar set of... some of them, wasn't sure if they were jokes or just statements of fact. But anyway, let's move on. Let's talk about the politics of all of this. This is Oliver Wright.
This was a budget in many ways as important for what it didn't say as for what it did. By turning on the spending caps and promising good times ahead, the implicit message to Tory MPs was, don't mess it up by voting down my Brexit deal. Expect this message to be hammered home in the weeks ahead. Boris Johnson may have promised £350 million for the NHS from Brexit. The message from Philip Hammond is, you won't get it if it's a hard Brexit.
One of the interesting things I thought was he only used the Brexit word once in his speech. I think you found it appeared three times
in the entirety of the budget Red Book, which is this sort of 60, 80 page odd document that goes alongside the speech and details all the announcements. It was there three places, but all of them in the same footnote. Contrast that with the OBR report, which granted was slightly longer than the Red Book, but that was 66 mentions of Brexit and some pretty substantive points that they made.
One of the most crucial being that in the event of us not securing a Brexit deal, basically all of their assumptions go out of the window. It could be quite hairy.
Well, more to the point, they've been banned from making such assumptions. I think this is one of... scandal is a much bandied around word, but I mean, surely if we as a country have an organisation like the OBR, which is designed to give independent forecasts, the government should be asking the OBR to look at those forecasts, and early, obviously for the internal Conservative Party politics, asking the OBR to say that a no-deal Brexit would be pretty bad news isn't something that is really within the power of the Chancellor to do. The economic forecasts ahead of the vote to leave were wrong. I think the public can take that in their stride. And we should know what the OBR thinks, personally.
I'm interested in one aspect of the relationship between the Prime Minister and the Chancellor. Now, we know that there was a falling out and that he was lucky to save his job. Are they now much closer? Do we see them as a central force in the Cabinet, fighting for a certain kind of cause?
I think politically they are closer. I'm not sure personally they are much closer. Some people describe them as a sort of squabbling couple. But what I do think was that when Philip Hammond used his pre-budget interviews on Sunday to explicitly or implicitly, depending on how you take it, warn that, you know, things could be pretty grim and some of this spending was dependent upon there being a Brexit with a smooth deal. And then the following day, Downing Street supposedly sort of slapped him down and said, no, you know, all this spending is written in stone. We've said we'll spend this money on the NHS. We will, regardless of what kind of Brexit we get. I think that was more of a two-step than a genuine row. Downing Street is not going to be unhappy with Phil Hammond being the outrider and warning that you've got to do a deal, otherwise things are going to be grim, because it suits May's agenda as much as it suits Hammond's.
I think actually a lot of the tension between them came from sort of Phil Hammond Mark One, was that he was not a big spender. He wasn't a big interventionist. The sort of early Theresa May wanting to intervene in markets, whether it was the energy market and the housing market, that's where they clashed ideologically. I don't think they also got on particularly well as, you know, as people, as colleagues, but it was that big conflict. Whereas now Philip Hammond's basically moved on to Theresa May's turf, is splashing all this cash, has gone along with, you know, the NHS spending. There's a suggestion that the price for that was that he got to bring forward the income tax cuts, which is a sort of more old-fashioned Tory thing, let's cut income tax. But I think there has definitely been a change in the relationship.
I mean, it definitely was a political budget. PwC calculated there were 86 budget measures, which is 15 more than last year, but only 33 related to tax measures, i.e. proper budget measures. And of those, only one raised more than a billion in any one year, and only one gave away more than a billion in one year. So that's not a... it suggests it was a political budget. It wasn't. This was not a proper, you know, let's deal with the economy budget.
In the run-up to it, certainly in recent months rather than in recent weeks, but Philip Hammond kept saying, you know, there aren't going to be big spending decisions. You have to wait for the spending review next year. And then there was spending all over the place. There was money for the NHS that we knew about. There's an extra £1 billion for defence. Ollie, there was this particularly odd moment when he started talking about schools and saying that I think he thought he was doing a nice thing and bringing forward a bit of extra spending for schools, but he described it as being for the little extras, which has gone down incredibly badly with schools who are struggling.
Really struggling. I mean, that was a classic piece of, yeah, you could see it looked good when they were writing it and they were trying to put it into language that people could understand, except people did understand it. And they said, well, you know, that's what schools should be getting anyway. They aren't little extras, you know, pens, papers, computer. That is the basis of being a school. I thought that was one of the things that would actually resonate with people out there beyond anything else. I mean, a lot of it will sort of go over people's heads, but something like that will be remembered.
And it's the sort of thing that will be brought up at parents' evenings. Because teachers do have an audience.
The schools are a network. Yeah. And, you know, lots of people are parents, lots of people talk to teachers. You know, part of the reason why Michael Gove lost the sort of, I wouldn't quite say political credibility, but his reputation was damaged beyond anything by the reforms that he made as education secretary. And people, you know, you just talk to people know Michael Gove and they remember him for being education secretary, not justice secretary, not environment secretary, certainly not chief whip. It was what he did at education that really resonated.
And the number of sort of school events I've been to for my daughters where the teacher or the head teacher says, you know, ends a sentence with no thanks to Mr. Gove, actually years after he stopped being education secretary. And no, these aren't little extras, Mr. Hammond. Yeah. Thing will probably resonate. Let's have a look at some of the one of the questions Chris Drew asks. We normally only see the chance of splashing the cash carefully to selected friends, that is, on the run-up to an election. Have the odds just shortened on a 2019 general election?
It's an interesting point, and he's not the only person to raise that. I noticed yesterday Stuart Wood, Lord Stuart Wood, who used to be an advisor to Ed Miliband and is a sort of a kind of new Labour figure, also did a long thread on Twitter suggesting that there might be a rationale for an election in 2019. And I think it's still an outside possibility, but I don't think you could rule it out entirely. If Theresa May gets a successful Brexit deal, if she thinks, you know, actually, I want to stay as Prime Minister, the only way really she could do that is against the wishes of the vast majority of her colleagues and backbenchers, is call another election and try and do it better next time.
I think it was on Good Morning Britain when Philip Hammond was asked, you know, are you gearing up for election? And he went, oh, I hope not. And it sort of fell out of his mouth before he had to. And then in later interviews, he was slightly more, no, this is just doing the right thing.
I mean, if this was normal times, and as you regularly point out, this is not normal times. You know, if these were normal times, then this was a year two budget in a five-year term. This should have been the budget where we got hit. This should have been the budget where you were saving up a little bit of a war chest, you know, for year four with the support of your backbenchers. But as we all know, there was no way he could take some of those tough measures. So even the IR35 change, which I'm sure Anne will talk about shortly, you know, that's been postponed, but, you know, it's not immediately. The big changes that he should be making in year two of a five-year term, there was no chance of him doing those.
You should hike up tax now, and then people have forgotten by the election, then you spend it all in election year and...
Or even better, hike up stealth taxes now, hope we don't notice, and then give us away the headline rate in year four. So this wasn't a normal budget. This should not have been a giveaway budget.
I think, just picking up on Richard's point, that I think one of the most interesting things was a line in the OBR report where they said it was too late to assess the changes that Hammond announced on universal credit because they'd only been introduced into the budget at the last moment. Now, you know, everyone knows that, you know, this was a story and an issue that has gone up the agenda in recent days, and it just shows the fragility of Hammond's position, that he was forced to sort of rip up what he'd done up until this point and add to the measures with the sort of giveaway on universal credit. That wasn't a sort of sign of strength. That was kind of a sign of weakness.
Buried in the definitions, there's a definition of a bottle return scheme, despite the fact there's no mention of it in the Red Book or in the speech, which may suggest that was probably cut out at the last moment. So as you say, it does look a little bit like it's a budget where there's been some last minute.
Somebody's not done a full control F on that to remove all references. And the Labour Party seem to be in a pickle about how to respond to this. In the run-up to it, they've been talking more about the end of austerity than almost the Conservative Party have. They seem genuinely spooked by the idea that if the Tories convince the public that austerity is coming to an end, that's a massive hole in Labour's strategy. And now you've got this weird thing of the Labour Party is backing the income tax cuts for which are going to benefit the top 10% most. It all seems very confusing.
The response wasn't necessarily prize-winning, was it? But they were relying on this whole tidal flow of rumoured measures that were supposed to be happening in the budget. There was list after list of all these things that the Chancellor would be changing, affecting, and they seemed entirely caught off their guard. Maybe nobody could have done any better in the circumstances.
Ollie, on the tax cuts in particular, you had Emily Thornberry, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, tweeting immediately afterwards saying this is awful, you know, tax cuts to the rich, that's the Tories for you. And then John McDonnell does a media round on Tuesday morning where he says that Labour's going to back them because he thinks that they might inject some firepower into the economy. Andy Burnham, the former Cabinet Minister, now Labour Mayor of Greater Manchester, he's written for Times Web Box Online on Tuesday saying, when he heard this, it sent shivers down his spine. It was like when Harriet Harman backed those welfare cuts just after the 2015 election, which he says basically paved the way for Jeremy Corbyn. They're in a bit of a pickle on this, aren't they?
They are, but the tone of surprise in your voice? I mean, I think it will pass everyone by. I mean, it's a really hard gig being leader of the opposition, having to respond to the budget. You know, you haven't really had time to, you know, read it. You've just had to listen to the sort of showmanship, and you've got to come up with something. It takes them a little bit of time. Even the slickest of operations takes a little bit of time to get a unified line, and, you know, the Labour leadership is not the slickest of operations.
They've got a very good video, which they released over the weekend, of what you assume is a Tory minister walking through some underpass as an aide says, what should we do about benefits? He just says, cut them. And then he takes a sandwich out of a man's hand who's in a wheelchair. And they go through a whole list of things like, cut them, we don't need those. And it sort of finishes with him saying, what should we do about education and health? And he just says, cut the lot, as if that was like their Tory's policy to abolish the NHS. And then they say, well, what about taxes for the rich and corporations? And he said, well, yeah, we should definitely cut those as well. And it's set to a very sort of cool soundtrack. It looks really slick. I'm not totally sure that the Labour response to the budget necessarily matches the message in that, but they are better at that, and presumably they just think that nobody's watching the actual budget and they're more likely to see their viral videos.
You might be right. I would say that video would be a far more potent message than anything that Jeremy Corbyn said after the budget speech.
And the other thing, I mean, the Treasury is at this as well now. One of the weirder things that I saw yesterday was the budget according to Gladstone the cat, which, you know, honestly, it's not a spoof. It was an official... Someone has spent quite a lot of time following this cat round the treasury, taking photographs of it yawning, sort of eating and playing with sort of fake mice, as they announced the five things that Gladstone the cat cares about in the budget. I mean,
well, I'm on record as saying I hate cats, so I've managed to avoid that entirely.
But even the idea, I mean, you now have, I mean, it's not just the odd leak now, you have 3 or 4 days of embargoed press releases day after day, you know, leaking half the measure. I mean, I know I'm old and old-fashioned, but, you know, I do remember the days where everything in a budget was a surprise, bar maybe one or two... Yeah. Very small policies that had been leaked to the Sundays, but everything else was a genuine surprise.
The surprising thing this time, they were leaking or pre-briefing so much that you'd have two stories in one press release.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one at the bottom would get slightly lost. I mean, it was really one of the difficulties we had. I mean, not only the fact that he decided to do it at 3:30, which obviously is also old-fashioned, but I don't welcome that return. But, you know, one of the problems was that there's so much been pre-leaked, we couldn't decide whether we should write about it again or whether it had been written about enough or whether we should... I mean, the leak now is ridiculous.
They still maintain the line when you phone them up and ask them, so we can't comment on budget speculation.
But we can press release it.
Yeah, we'll email you over some speculation shortly. Right, in a sec, we'll move on and talk about what this actually means for normal people and money in their pockets. In just a sec, we'll be back after this short break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Red Box Politics Podcast in the Times. I'm Matt Chorley, joined in the studio by Richard Fletcher, Ollie Wright, and this is Anne Ashworth.
At times, the budget was like being at an embarrassing wedding. Not just because the Chancellor's Labour jokes reminded you of a certain sort of father of the bride. Phil Hammond was scattering measures like confetti, a little something for almost everyone, a bit more in wage packets, a bit for first-time buyers, and so on. But there was no stimulus for the property market, and the unlocking of sites for new homes has been delayed again. The pension tax reliefs remain untouched, but for how long can that last?
And you touched on housing there. A few weeks ago, I spoke to someone at the Treasury who would know about these things and asked, is there going to be a big housing thing? And they said, well, it won't be the biggest thing, but there was going to be something from housing. And that just seems to have just dropped out. I mean, even Richard saying there was a change on Help to Buy, but that he didn't even mention it.
The changes on Help to Buy are quite extensive, and they were, as Richard said, hidden away in one of the budget backing documents.
Could you explain briefly what they are?
Well, essentially, the scheme is going to be extended, but there will be caps on the amount that you can use, which is a response to the huge controversy of the enrichment of bosses of house builders thanks to Help to Buy. And that has caused a huge amount of opposition to the scheme, some of which is unwarranted in my view. But in the speech, he concentrated on a tiny measure allowing people who buy a shared ownership property to claim back the stamp duty that they may have paid. And he did reiterate the statement that councils would be allowed to borrow to build new homes. But the central thing we were all waiting for was the Letwin report, which is all about ensuring that homes on sites on which there is planning consent are delivered. And I expected a keynote statement on that. Again, that has been delayed. Now, was there opposition to landowners on the idea that you might be seizing some of their profit if they delay the delivery of homes? Or was it, as some might suspect, fear of the NIMBY tendency out there in the shires that sees the word development and feels very, very threatened and rises up in opposition?
Theresa May has described dealing with the housing crisis as her personal mission. How do you think that mission's going?
All I know is that at the party conference, there's a huge amount of data going around about how many people have moved to Labour because they don't see the Tories as the party of aspiration towards own home ownership anymore. And there has been something that they call the rent quake, where if you feel that you will never own, you are naturally a Labour voter. And Labour was saying something about attracting young professionals who feel dispossessed. Now, there was no rhetoric in the speech reaching out to that crucial demographic of voters whom the Tories need if they are going to win at the next election.
In fact, Ollie, there wasn't very much rhetoric at all in it. It was difficult to know what was the slogan that he would have wanted people to use as the headline. Yeah. And despite having gone on for 75 minutes, it sort of suddenly finished.
No, it was interesting because I wrote the sort of Our Media online piece on it. You've got to sort of listen and sort of half think what you're writing and trying to pull it together. And clearly, first phrase he used, the end of austerity is coming near. Yeah, I wrote that down. And then found it sort of, 69 minutes in, I was sticking with the sort of first thing that I've written down. And other than that, no, you're absolutely right. There wasn't a great deal of that.
There was the usual start of strivers and, those of us with
and grafters and
alarm clocks. I do wonder, do politicians think that, only a few percent of the population have alarm clocks? Because I thought most people had them, but, so there was the usual strivers rhetoric. But you're right, there wasn't an overwhelming message.
We are the builders, which is one of my favourite, the George Osborne.
But I suppose if you were sitting in the Treasury, there was a clear message, the end of austerity is nearly over if you do what I say, and they probably didn't want to confuse the message.
Let's talk about IR35. Explain to people who might not know, what is IR35?
IR35, possibly the most contentious thing you can imagine. Now, you can work and essentially be self-employed, or you could be. And first, that was the rules allowing you to do that were changed for the public sector. And now they're going to be changed for the private sector. That means if you go into a job as a consultant or whatever you call yourself, and you essentially look like any other employee, but are enjoying national insurance and other benefits, those are going to be taken away from you. That has caused considerable unrest among that community of contractors, principally because they feel as if they're being accused of tax avoidance when they were only complying with the rules that the taxman had laid out some years ago. Philip Hammond, I think, has an instinctive dislike of there being two classes of employed person, a self-employed person and an ordinary worker, and he wants them to be treated just the same, whereas these people who were enjoying the IR35 concessions feel that they were taking some risk upon themselves and so deserve some more reward in the form of tax breaks.
Philip Hammond's sort of worldview of normal people in normal, 9-to-5 jobs and they get a salary at the end of the month is part of the tension in the Treasury, because on the other side you've got Liz Truss, who's part of the Uber-wielding, Deliveroo-riding warriors, or something she calls themselves. And she's all about the gig economy and being more flexible and all that sort of thing. And that's where treating people who, they take some of the risk of being essentially self-employed. But as a result, and so they get some perk from that as well.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I suppose here's the question. I mean, given the changing nature of the economy, I assume the figures show that the number of people who are in this kind of work is going up quite rapidly. And if you're trying to protect your revenues, you need to try and somehow equalise it. And you're certainly not going to equalise it by giving the tax benefits to, you know, 9-to-5 workers. So you can see a sort of practical, beyond a political point to it, but there's a sort of practical good management point to it in protecting the revenues that you've got. I don't know whether that's...
I would just come back to the way in which this has been framed. It seems like everybody that was enjoying these concessions is about to email or text one of us at Times Money. But they feel as if those concessions were legal. That was the tax law at this time. It has been changed. Perhaps they can accept that. But deeming what the way they worked and the way they ran their finances as tax avoidance, which we see as egregious, is distasteful to them.
Don't give out my email address at the end of this, but these aren't, we're not talking about Uber drivers here. We're talking about IT contractors, we're talking about accountants, and we're talking about people who, you know, who may have ended up working for one company for many, many years, and basically they've had a very good ride of it for a few years, and the Treasury quite rightly has looked at it and said, hold on a second, you're not paying national insurance, your employer isn't having to pay you holiday pay or pension or, you know, all those things we think responsible employers should do. There's more and more of you, and actually we want to change the rules, and we've given you plenty of notice, which they have. If you were a contractor and you haven't seen this one coming, then you haven't been paying very much attention. And we're not going to introduce
it. Richard Dot Fletcher.
We're not doing it particularly quickly, and therefore I've got, you know, if you're working in a company and you're directly employed and you're working in the IT department and you're paying, you know, you're paying your national insurance and, you know, you're paying through the PayWay system, and the guy sitting on the desk next to you is a contractor and has been there for the last 3 years and is paying, you know, probably half the tax that you are, and also when he retires isn't going to have a pension, so you're going to end up bailing him out then as well. I haven't got a huge amount of sympathy, as you might be able to tell.
They are, however, a vocal group, and it's quite interesting, as Richard has pointed out, that they have delayed the implementation of this until 2020. Now, we had thought that this would come into effect in April 2019. Is this giving everybody in the Treasury enough time to go to change their emails, change any way that they'd be contacted? Because these people have had it really good and now they're pretty angry.
I'm conscious that we're running out of time, but Anne, you're always so good when people ask very specific questions. Keith Tunstall asks, we're keen to downsize but cannot sell our house in today's market. We're thinking of renting out at the other end and letting our current house. Thus, we reluctantly become a landlord. The situation might go on for years. I'm sure Brexit uncertainty will continue into the transition period. Are we going to be liable for capital gains tax when we finally sell our current house?
Right, Keith, there's a huge amount in your questions. A, should there have been some stamp duty concession to encourage you to downsize and free up your family house? Yes, certainly, but there wasn't one. Now, what you are going to become if you follow through with this plan is what's called an accidental landlord. And yes, there was something in the budget which will hit you. Once upon a time, you could move out of your house and you had a period of grace in which to rent it out and then sell it, which lasted for 18 months. And that's going to be cut to 9 months. Now, there may be some argy-bargy about that. There may be concessions. But this is part of the whole toughening up of the tax regime that covers any kind of landlord, whether you treat it as a business or you've just happened to become a landlord. So certainly you will be liable for CGT.
See, this is a proper reader service. Thank you, as ever, Anne. Just very quickly, it's quite often when we talk about the budget and we do podcast specials and all that, a week later we've sort of forgotten it ever happened. Do we all think that this is a different kettle of fish? This is a moment that we'll remember?
We will never forget the embarrassment of those jokes.
Ollie? I don't think this is a classic budget. I think within a few days Brexit will rear its ugly head again and we'll all have forgotten about it.
I suspect we will, unless, you know, it was a free Freddie budget. As we said, there's a lot in the documents that we haven't yet come out of. So unless there's something buried in there, which is the next pasty tax, we probably will, yes.
Well, let's end it on the mention of pasties, which is always a good way to end a conversation. My huge thanks to Anne, Ollie and Richard. Don't forget you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, on your Android device and now on Spotify, excitingly. And you can subscribe to my morning email. Go to thetimes.co.uk/redbox. But for now, for me, Matt Chorley, it's goodbye.
Even even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.